Okay, good afternoon. Thanks everyone for coming. The sign-up sheet is going around, so definitely names and emails for communication between Shiurim would be great as well. For those who haven't met in person, I'm Yair Lechtman. I'm looking forward to meeting and learning with everyone as part of this series and many other frameworks as well. So our plan for today is to do something of an introduction to Sefer Tehillim, trying to get at some of the background that I think is necessary or at least helpful in understanding different Mizmorim of Tehillim, and trying to avoid that which isn't. So there are definitely some topics or subtopics that I've skipped that you know might belong in an introduction, but we're not going to cover today. But we'll do our best to cover the perspectives that I think are relevant and helpful, both in terms of the background, like what is Tehillim, what genre is it, what is it trying to do or talk about, and also, as students of Tehillim, what are we looking for? What are our goals as we do this reading? So those are the two main things we'll try to cover today. We have a couple of subheadings that we'll get to in time. And then at the end, I have some ideas, but I'm also happy to hear from the group here, like what would be interesting, what approaches to take, especially what might be already familiar to us, so where we might want to go if we haven't seen different aspects of Tehillim before. So we'll get to that a little bit later. The topics we'll try to cover today are, number one, the authorship of Tehillim, right? Who wrote Tehillim, and whether that is going to be important for us, whether the author might matter in terms of understanding an individual perek. Then, who Tehillim is for, meaning what population is being spoken to or about, and what Tehillim is for, meaning what purpose we might have in studying Tehillim or in reciting Tehillim, why we might want or need to use it. At the end, we may see if we have time to discuss the structure of Sefer Tehillim, but because our series is more, at least as of now, intended to be a little bit more episodic, meaning we'll sort of be jumping to different mizmorim that are relevant, we won't necessarily be doing every parak in order, so the macro structure of the book, right, the overall order and organization of 150 chapters might be a little bit less important, but if we have time, we may touch on that a little bit as well. So let's start from the beginning. Sefer Tehillim. It's a book we have in Tanakh. Who wrote this book? So we have at the beginning, in source number one, on page number one, a Gemara from Masechet Bava Batra. This is one of the first sources you'll see on any source sheet describing who wrote any book of Tanakh, because it gives you the order, or an order. You'll already notice that it's not exactly like the order that we have in our Tanakh, and authorship of different books of Tanakh. So we could start, the first line, Sidran Shel Ketuvim. So it just told us, it didn't tell us the order of the Torah, it assumes that we know Bereishit, Shemot, Vayikra, etc. It gave us the order of Nevi'im, which was a little bit different than the order we have, and now the order of Ketuvim, which is going to be notably different than the one that we have in an average Tanakh we pick up nowadays. Sidran Shel Ketuvim, so we start with Sefer Rut, then Sefer Tehillim, Iov, Mishlei Kohelet Shir HaShirim, Kinot, which is Eicha, that's the way that Chazal usually refer to Eicha, Daniel, Megillat Esther, the only one called a Megillah, interestingly, is Megillat Esther, not any other one, then Ezra, and Divrei HaYamim. Anyone pick up on the principle here? How do we order the books? It's a little bit subtle.
There's a
It's chronological. Yeah, exactly, right? So you start with Ruth, right? Ruth precedes David HaMelech, right? She is David HaMelech's ancestor. Then David wrote Tehillim, as we'll see. Iov is a little bit complicated because there are 10 different opinions about who wrote Iov, mentioned in the Gemara. Then Mishlei Kohelet Shir HaShirim Shlomo, Kinot is Yirmiyahu already at the end of the first Beit HaMikdash, and then Daniel, Esther, Ezra, Divrei HaYamim are all books from Galut Bavel or even a little bit later.
That's interesting that the three books written by Shlomo are in a different order than we think of they were actually written. We usually think of Shir HaShirim as the first one he wrote. So
if we were dealing with the Sifrei Shlomo, that would be a really important point. There are different midrashim about what order Shlomo wrote the different books, right? So is Kohelet, you know, Shlomo's mature, thoughtful reflections on life after having lived a great deal of it, or is Kohelet somewhat immature, and then he matures in his relationship with Judaism and religion and as he gets to later books? So that's certainly, an open question, but definitely interesting observation as well. I think those are the only ones that are definitely the same, era that we get that same, picture into, right? Those three books written by Shlomo Mishlei Kohelet Shirim. The rest of them are different people. So, okay, so we have Tehillim, which seems to be placed early on because we say David HaMelech wrote Tehillim, right? It's a little bit more complicated. The Gemara goes on after discussing a little bit more of the order and quibbling about where certain books belong in this order. We now go to the authorship piece. David katav Sefer Tehillim. David wrote Sefer Tehillim. Al Yidei Asara Zekenim. By way of 10 elders. By way of is a really funny phrase, right? It's unclear if that means he like employed 10 people to write, or if he gathered the work of 10 people. Is he even included in this count of 10? That's a little bit ambiguous, but it becomes clearer as we keep reading. So who are the elders that he's quoting from? So Al Yedei Adam Harishon, Al Yedei Malki Tzedek, who's another character from Bereishit, I think they're also mentioning these characters in chronological order. Al Yedei Avraham, Al Yedei Moshe, Al Yedei Heman, Al Yedei Yedutun, Al Yedei Asaf, Al Yedei Shloshet B'nei Korach. Okay, so this is, offhand seems a little bit random, right? This would be a great thing to read after we've read Tehillim, because then we'd understand it a lot better. Because as we read through Sefer Tehillim, we'll see lots of the chapters begin with, Mizmor Le'Asaf. It's a very common one. Or Le David Mizmor. So they're telling us who ostensibly wrote that chapter. It's giving us the, by so-and-so, and then giving us the poem afterwards. So for most of these names, it's pretty clear in the beginning of individual Mizmorim that they were written by those people. A few of them are a little bit harder. Like, there's no Mizmor that says Le Avraham, but there are other names that Avraham seems to have as Sefer Tehillim. He's called Eitan HaEzrachi. So Avraham gets one, Adam Harishon gets one. But these seem to be the people who, look, we look at Sefer Tehillim, we see all these names at the beginning that tell us who seemed to write an individual parak, and it sounds like David HaMelech took all of those different chapters, including many that he wrote himself. I think there are 73, I want to say, in Tehillim that say David at the beginning, and then some smaller number for the rest of them, and put them all together into a book, and the book was called Sefer Tehillim. And that's like the standard, mainstream, middle-of-the-road approach. It's explicit in the Gemara, which already gives it a certain standing, right? If it's in the Gemara, it has a lot of significance for us. And that's the mainstream. Now, that being the mainstream doesn't mean it's the only approach, and there are extremes in both directions. So to choose an extreme in one direction, we have views that suggest that David HaMelech wrote all of Tehillim, even the chapters that seem to be written by other people, because they have other people's names at the beginning. Like, just use one really obvious example, L'Shlomo. A few chapters begin to Shlomo. So did David write those about Shlomo or to Shlomo? Could be. Shlomo was alive when David was alive. Or Shlomo wrote them, and then it's very funny to say David wrote them. But you do have this view that David wrote all of them. Quoted in the source number 3 in the Gemara Pesachim. Haya Rabbi Meir, Omer, Rabbi Meir would say, or used to say, Kol ha-tushbachot ha-amuro be-sefer Tehillim, all of the praises in Sefer Tehillim, kulan David amaran. David said all of them. Shana Amar, and it quotes a pasuk, Kalut filo David ben Yishai, which is a pasuk in source number 2. It means the end of the tefillot of David ben Yishai. But the Midrash is understanding that, Al tikri kalu ela kol elu. It's not that the tefillot of David were finished, but rather, all of these, everything in this book of Tehillim was written by David. That's like the most extreme version that says David wrote everything here. That's a little bit problematic, again, because some Mizmorim seem to be attributed explicitly to other people. And some of them don't seem to fit chronologically. So the one that might be most well-known is Al-Naharot Bavel. It's Tehillim chapter 137, right? It's explicitly placed as the Jews are heading towards exile in Bavel, which is at the end of the period of the first Beit HaMikdash, whereas David preceded the first Beit HaMikdash. So you'll say David had a prophecy, he knew that it would happen in the future. It's possible, but it's a little bit challenging to say things like that. And even the pasuk that the Gemara quotes to prove that is a little bit funny, because the pasuk says, the tefillot of David ben Yishai ended, and you'll look at the chapter number there, in source number 2, Tehillim 72. So it sounds like, up till 72 is David, then they add a little line at the end saying, oh, you should know, David didn't do, this is where David's end, and the rest of them are probably not David. So, but you see it's a little bit of a stretch there on the one extreme. The idea of David, by the way, having a nevuah also comes up in source number 4. We won't read it inside in the interest of time, but it's explicit there that David had nevuah about the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and even the second, and was prophesying about that in his writing, in Tehillim Kuf Lamed Zayin. So that's the one extreme, and that's also adopted by Rav Sadia Gaon as well in the period of the Rishonim. There's this excellent book that I'm working my way through now, so I'll probably be quoting it a few more times. It's called Arba Gishot LeSefer Tehillim, Four Approaches to the Book of Tehillim, by Professor Uriel Simon, who was a professor at Bar-Ilan University. And he starts off with Rav Sadia Gaon's approach, and notes that it's sort of a little bit extreme. It's also on the cover. There's an English translation, and it's fairly accessible. I think you could order it on Amazon and have it here in a day or two. It's a really interesting book. It is a little bit dense and a little bit academic, but if you have the patience to chew through it, I'm sure you'd enjoy it. Good question. Yeah, so this book is not a commentary on Tehillim. What he's doing, rather, is he's summarizing the approaches of different medieval authorities, Sadia Gaon, Ibn Ezra, a few of the other commentaries, including some Karaite commentaries, and specifically regarding the question, like, what kind of book is it? So Sadia Gaon, as we'll see quoted a little bit later, thinks that Tehillim is basically, we think Tehillim is, we're davening to Hashem, right? They're prayers that human beings compose to praise Hashem, ask for things from Hashem. Sadia Gaon says, no, it's actually prophecy, Hashem communicating to us, just in a kind of funny language, right? So we'll could even skip there now. It's on the bottom of page number 3, a little quote there. Sadia Gaon basically describes, I'll translate it quickly, Sadia Gaon behaktamato, it's the last paragraph there. In his intro to Tehillim, Af Yit'im describes, shekol ha-tchinot shabat Tehillim asuyot bin ha-keli yit-parish. Every request, right, every, you know, beseechment in Tehillim can be easily explained, shehim divrei hatafat lekach musar. Now, they're actually lessons for us to learn. And he gives an example. Kigon, milashon ha-tchina, shema Hashem v'chaneni, Hashem haye ozerli, Hashem, listen to me, be kind and gracious to me, help me. All of that is a code. Sadia Gaon says what it really means. Yesh lahasik et divrei hatafat halekach. The moral, Hashem shomea tefillah. Hashem hears our prayers. Chanunhu, he is gracious and kind. Ve'ozer lirayav, and he helps those who fear him. So it looks like we're begging for something from Hashem, but actually it's just a coded way for Hashem to communicate to us. Which is, it's kind of funny, but that's the kind of thing that you'll see in this book by Professor Simon. An overall approach to the book, and he gives a few examples for how you might read individual prakim. But it's not a great, like, parak by parak commentary. I'm looking at a few now, and if anyone wants recommendations as we go, I'm happy to, you know, describe the ones I take a look at when I've gotten a chance to go through them. Okay, so we've just back to our point about who wrote Tehillim. So we have our mainstream approach. David wrote it with some anthologizing of other authors. The most extreme is David wrote all of it, even though that doesn't seem to fit all the data that we have. On the other hand, we have the source in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, from Midrash and Shir HaShirim, describing the 10, you know, authors, so to speak, of Tehillim, the 10 people who are being quoted. I'll just read it in English in the interest of time. 10 people said the book of Psalms. So who are the 10? Adam, Harishon, Avraham, Moshe, David, Shlomo. Everyone agrees about those 5. And then there are 5 that are disputed. But you'll notice that we get a little bit past the period we were talking about before. So Rav and Rav Yochanan debate who was included here. Rav says, Asaf, Heman, Yedutun. These seem to be Leviim and, you know, the Beit HaMikdash around the period of David HaMelech. The 3 sons of Korach, who are, we know from earlier in the Torah as well, and Ezra. And also, the other list is very similar. Asaf, Heman, Yedutun, then each of the 3 sons of Korach. So Asaf, Heman, Yedutun are all count as 1. The 3 sons of Korach are 3, that's 4. And Ezra again. So this view suggests not that David wrote with earlier authorities and kind of collected earlier religious poems and put them into Tehillim, but he actually borrowed, or he wrote, you know, I guess most of Tehillim, but later things might have been added by people like Ezra. So the best example would be Al Naharot Bavel. Any poem about the exile, you know, it would be very hard to explain that was written before and then passed down. This approach existed in the Middle Ages, existed in Chazal, and was rekindled even in the 19th century by Malbim, who's, you know, competing with the Reform movement. You know, the Reformers say, it doesn't make sense. How can you say that David wrote Tehillim? There are passages that seem to talk about far later in the future than David. And Malbim says, so I could tell you that it's all prophecy and we believe in the power of prophecy. And he does conclude that he actually prefers that approach. But he also thinks it's perfectly legitimate to say, well, no one said you have to believe that David wrote that chapter, that it actually could be someone who was at the time of the exile in Babel, who was reflecting on his religious experience then. And I have a midrash that says it. I'm not, you know, a wild reformer for suggesting so. I'm basing myself on traditional authority. So it is rekindled, even in the modern period, as kind of a live, you know, religiously acceptable option that we see.
Just a quick question.
Sure, please.
Okay, so I can get, okay, this one wrote this, this wrote that, especially mm-hmm. when it says the sons of Korach, okay. And then I can assume by oral tradition, these were memorized in Pesach. Adam Avisha.
So Adam and Rishon is interesting, right? Some of them are a little bit more obvious. They say their names in the beginnings. So I don't have, I could pick up the Gemara now and take a look at it. I didn't put it on the sheet. Rashi explains how there's one mizmor that even though it doesn't say Adam's name, references Adam HaRishon, and we should assume from Chazal's tradition that it should
they
be him.
Through it.
Right, so each of these, you know, Rashi will explain the ones that are not obvious, right? Like Asaf or Shimri's Mor of Nekorach, he explains why we think that, you know, this person or that person would have written individuals of them.
And why did Adam Avishon...
Oh, why would he have written a poem at all? Like, explain his purpose.
Did he write anything else?
So I think that'll get a little bit closer to one of our later sections, which is like, what the point of Tehillim is, right? So it's a book, right? Like, why would a person have felt the need to write anything? Right? Why did Adam...
Well,
no, right, we're all sitting in a Beit Midrash now. We're looking at the wall of Sfarim. but it becomes a tricky question, right? Like, you know, you were learning Sefer Shmuel this past year with Rabbi Goldstein, right? So I get asked the question, like, so Shmuel Hanavi wrote Sefer Shmuel. What was he trying to communicate to the people? Is he communicating some lesson about kingship in general, or the qualities that make a good king, the legitimacy of the Davidic monarchy and David being the exclusive king? Like, there's some message that you get from the book. And there might be sub-messages also. You could do the same thing for pretty much any book of the Torah, or the book of Tanakh, rather. So we could ask that, well, we will come to ask that question for Tehillim, what the purpose of this book existing is. And then we could ask related questions. Like, it's one thing to say there's a purpose of the book of Kohelet, and there's another thing to say, there's a purpose of saying Kohelet on Chol HaMoed Sukkot. And those may not be the same either. So we'll definitely touch on that very shortly.
Okay.
Yeah, Sarah?
I'm not sure I got what the difference was between two opinions.
In the Midrash and Shir HaShirim? So they all agree about the identities of these people. Asaf, Hemani, Dutun, three sons of Korach and Ezra. They debate the count. So the first version says Asaf, Hemani, Dutun are three. The sons of Korach are really one, meaning they collectively write one thing, so they don't get counted individually, and Ezra. I think actually in the second count, when it says Asaf, Heman, and Yedutun are one, I don't think it's saying that there are three names for one person. I think they would understand, for example, for any beginning of a Perek of Tehillim, right? It says Asaf, it says Yedutun, whatever introduction it is. So that could mean different things, right? It could mean it was written by that person, if it's a person, that's a personal name. It could refer to a musical style, right, when it says La Menatzeach. So is there a person who's the Menatzeach? Is the Menatzeach like a genre of poetry? Or a musical style that we, you know, sing this poem to a guitar? So each intro could mean something different. I think Yedutun is one of those ambiguous ones that when we read a parak that begins like that, we'll want to know, is it telling me how to play the song, how to sing the song, how to read the poem, or who wrote the poem? And there are different options for different introductions. Okay, so that is our first piece, sort of identifying where this book fits in. I think most Mizmorim that we read won't be so, our interpretation of those Mizmorim won't be so affected by this question, because most of them are David anyway. There are a few that would be a little bit fuzzy. So for example, if you're going to place things in the time of Ezra, so the experience of someone in the time of Ezra might be reflecting different set of values than the experience of someone at David's time, or the experience of someone at Avraham's time. And so contextualizing it in the lives of these characters or in the periods of Jewish history might be important. Similarly, we could talk about like who Tehillim is for, meaning what population is being spoken to. And again, there seems to be a little bit of ambiguity there. I think I could identify what seemed to me to be three different modes of Sefer Tehillim. We'll take a look at the source number 6 and 7, and we'll try to articulate those a little bit more clearly. So this Gemara Pesachim we quoted a little bit earlier, in the context of talking about Hallel on the Seder night, so it discusses some general issues in Sefer Tehillim. And here's one of them. Kol shirot v'tushpachot ta'amar David b'Sefer Tehillim, Rabbi Eliezer Omer keneged atzmo amaran. So David wrote a parak of Tehillim, he was writing for or about himself. So when he says, Shema Hashem chanini Hashem eyeh ozerli, David HaMelech himself is crying out to Hashem to be heard and saved. And there are some prakim of Tehillim where it's very obvious, where the introduction says, you know, David said this when he was chased out of Yerushalayim by Avshalom. So he is in a state of distress now, and he is praying for his own personal situation. I call that one mode, right? There's a personal mode where the author of the Mizmor is talking about themselves in their lives. And that's the best place where we'll want to wonder, well, depending on who wrote it, that might impact our understanding. Right, a mizmor written to Shlomo or about Shlomo is different than one written by Shlomo. Rabbi Yoshua Omer keneged tzibur amaran. That's a little bit of a different perspective. In other words, it's not written personally from my religious experience. It was written on behalf of or for the community at large. So what that means itself is still a little bit fuzzy, but at the very least, it makes it less important to focus on David HaMelech's life story and what he's thinking about and feeling, and to become a little bit more general in our interpretation. Now, it could mean keneged hatzibur, meaning trying to speak to the generic person's experience, right? That's what I call like the universal mode, right? It's one that allows anyone to relate to any given parak, even though they're not David, even though they don't live in his exact circumstance. It could also be, I'm not sure if that's what it's getting at here. It could also be a national mode of reading, right? So Al Naharot Bavel is again a great example of this, right? The national experience of the Jewish people on their way to exile is what's being described in that mizmor. And so it's not my personal experience as an exile, it's what is the nation of Israel feeling now. And that might lead to some different interpretations as well. So that those three main modes, I think, are generally applicable. Some of them are a little bit specific. Some of them will have to be interpreted personally, right? The ones about David lamenting his sin with Bathsheba will generally be more personal. Some national ones will be a little bit obvious as well. And even the first one is more, right? Ashrei Eish Asher Lo Halach Ba'atzat Rasha'im, that talks about, generally speaking, you know, the pursuit of wisdom and the folly of wickedness, seems to be a little bit more universal than that. It's not about David HaMelech individually or Am Yisrael as a nation, but the human condition broadly, and all people can relate to it. There are middle positions, and I think that's what the Chachamim here are saying in source 6. The Chachamim Omrim, Yesh Mehem Keneged Tzibur, Yesh Mehem Keneged Atzmo. Some are general, and some are individual. Ha'amurot Balashon Yachid Keneged Atzmo. Some are use a singular language, and those are personal. He's writing for himself. Ha'amurot Balashon Rabim Keneged Tzibur. And some are in the plural, grammatically speaking, and so they relate to the community as a whole. And as we read Sefer Tehillim, that'll in general be something that's important to note. When we're speaking in singular, when we're speaking in plural, and relatedly, and there's not what's coming up in this source, but I'll point it out now as we, you know, anticipate some of the prakim we'll see, we'll also have to ask the question about what like tense we're talking in. You know, first person, second person, third person could lead to different poetic experiences. Am I describing my experience now? Am I communicating to Hashem? Am I describing someone else's experience or a general human experience? Am I talking in the past tense or the future tense? The meaning of a given poem will actually depend on how seriously you take those, right? Is a future tense a prayer for the future? I talked about this a little bit in a shiur on the tefillah of Yonah in the fish, because it's a little bit unclear. He seems to be describing how he was already saved, but he's still in the fish. So different commentaries debate, is he praying for the future, but he's just so confident that he'll be accepted that he uses the past tense? Or is he actually, does he already feel like he was saved from drowning, so he's giving thanksgiving even though he's still in the fish? That was a discussion we had there. And so in any parak of Tehillim, we could wonder, is this spoken from the perspective of a person who is in danger, who wants salvation, from a person who's already been saved, who's expressing thanks? And noticing that as we read is going to be important as well. We will skip source number 7. I think it sort of reiterates the main modes of understanding Tehillim, the personal, the national, and the universal. As a rule, I'm a little bit partial to the universal modes of reading Tehillim. I think that makes it more relatable to us, that we want to read a parak of Tehillim and relate it to our own religious experiences, as opposed to focusing on David or focusing on the history.
This universal view, would that speak to why there's 150? Maybe there's 160, and 10 didn't make it in because they covered maybe the same territory?
So that's an interesting question, right? How the things that came into Tehillim got into Tehillim is an important thing to think about and to study. So the first thing I'll point to is, right, Chazal have the statement that the only nevuot that were written down and preserved in Tanakh were the ones that had important messages l'dor, for the future. Exactly. So, you know, there are psukim that suggests David writing not 150 songs, but thousands of songs. Well, we don't have thousands of prakim of Tehillim, so obviously some of them were not deemed worthy to have been, you know, kept in Tehillim. Or maybe weren't universal, right? Just to quote the line from source number 7, everything David said in his book, Tehillim, he said for himself, mm-hmm. for all of Israel, and for all time. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that many of the Mizmorim were just not for all time, and so they didn't need to be preserved. We could track, you know, very thoroughly all the data from Shmuel, from Divrei Hayamim, about exactly how prolific a musician he was.
Or a bad day, and he wrote the same thing in a variety of manners.
It could be. It could be. The one tricky thing is that you do have a couple of places in Tehillim where the same texts or the same same phrases are preserved even multiple times.
Yeah.
I think it's...
We all like that, aren't we?
Right, exactly. So we have to wonder, maybe they were preserved in slightly different ways because the slight differences matter, or maybe they were preserved in different collections, right? We have 5 books of Tehillim, so it's possible we had these different books and the books were then put into a Tanakh. That's also possible. But the composition becomes very tricky, especially when you start incorporating like broader evidence than what we have in Tanakh. So a source I didn't put on the sheet, there's a Midrash quoted in the Talmud Yerushalmi that says, why does Tehillim have 147 chapters? Because Yaakov Avinu lived for 147 years. So that's a very funny Midrash. What they might mean is that our chapter divisions aren't the chapter divisions that everyone agreed to. So there are some indications that, for example, the first 2 chapters of Tehillim might actually be like a single poetic unit. And depending on the chapter, we could focus on questions like that. So all the composition and organization pieces can be really teased out ad infinitum. And at the end of the day, most people will throw their hands up at some point and say, here's our best guess, and we have to start understanding the book that we have. Okay, with the time we have remaining, I want to try to answering the question, what is Tehillim for? Both, what is Tehillim for practically, what could it be used for, and what is the purpose of learning or studying Sefer Tehillim? So we start with source number 8, again, the Gemara and Psachim on Daf Kuf Yud Zayin, 117, one more time. So it notes that there sometimes you have chapters of Tehillim that begin Le David Mizmor, and sometimes you have Mizmor Le David. So, is there a difference? Yes, says the Gemara. Le David Mizmor means Milameh Shesharta Alav Shechina. The translation, by the way, is on page 3. Shesharta Alav Shechina V'achar Kach Amar Shira. When it says Le David Mizmor, it means that first the, you know, divine presence, the Ruach HaKodesh, whatever you'll call it, inhabited David, and then he wrote the Shira. So in other words, the Shira has a certain divine quality to it. It's a little bit more of Hashem speaking to us and a little bit less of us speaking to Hashem, because first David was inhabited by, possessed by Ruach HaKodesh and then spoke. But when it says Mizmor LeDavid, Melamed She'amar Shira, V'achar Kach Sharta Alav Shechina. So first David wrote and sang the song and only then was inhabited with the Shechina afterwards. So I think there are two possible takeaways from this. Right? One is, perhaps the purpose of writing certain shirim, is so that the Shekhinah would come down. Right? One purpose of the shira might be to bring the presence of the Shekhinah. We have this idea that music, in particular, we see this in Shmuel and Malachim, that music has a way of inspiring prophecy, inspiring the presence of Shekhinah. So perhaps some of the Mizmorim had a practical purpose, right? And prophets would sing them as part of an attempt to bring the divine presence down. I think it also points to the idea that some Mizmorim are more, you know, divinely sanctioned songs composed by people. Right? David wrote a song expressing very personally and without the divine, you know, aid, his feelings. And then the Shekhinah comes down and inhabits him and shows that the song was worthy of being accepted in some sense. So you see the tension between how much Tehillim is a top-down book versus a bottom-up book. Also, it's in Ketuvim, which may also weigh in on this question, but we're not going to deal with that extensively now. And this idea that part one function of Tehillim might be religious inspiration in the prophetic sense. Let's become prophets by studying Tehillim. That's one perspective. Another, and this is possibly controversial, I'll share it because I think it's too good a source not to share, but I want to be clear that I'm not criticizing the religious practice of others. So this is a passage in the Sefer HaChinuch. Mitzvah 5.12, Tavkuf Yud Bet in the Sefer HaChinuch, is the prohibition of Chover Chaver, which is a certain kind of like magical incantations that are prohibited. And in the context of that mitzvah, Sefer HaChinuch says, okay, so this is prohibition of Chover Chaver, of these divine incantations, but don't worry, that's not the same as when people recite Tehillim. That comparison is a kind of stark one, but we'll see how he describes it. Don't think that reciting Tehillim as a tefillah, as people do, is similar to Chover Chaver. And we know that's not true, because the Gemara in Shavuot says, Asur lihitraput b'divrei Torah. I can't take the words of Torah and use them like a magic formula, a magic incantation. If I keep reciting this pasuk over and over, so-and-so will be healed. That's prohibited, right? The Torah is not magic. It's not voodoo. It doesn't work that way. How does it work, says the Sefer HaChinuch? I think in a much more naturalistic kind of way. I'll read from the English here. Rather, they maintain, it's the third line in the English, the sixth word on the line. Rather, they maintain, mentioned it to say these psalms, that have things that arouse the soul of the one who knows them. The purpose of reciting the psalms is to inspire yourself, to take refuge in God, to have bitachon, may he be blessed, to put all of his trust in him, to fix his awe, Hashem's awe, in his, the human's, heart, and to rely upon his kindness and his goodness. And from the arousal to this, from being inspired by reciting Tehillim in this way, then he'll be protected from all damage. Right, so reciting Tehillim to have a refuah shlema is not a magic formula. It's character growth. I study Tehillim. I inspire myself with proper character traits: trust in Hashem, faith in Hashem. The more I talk about and pray for Hashem to save me, the more I inculcate the belief that I rely on Hashem to save me, and that's a powerful religious belief. By inculcating those religious beliefs, I improve my character and I become more worthy of being healed and being saved. So don't think that reciting Tehillim is like a magic incantation. It has character growth effects.
But that doesn't explain why we say Tehillim for the Rufat Shema of other people.
Mm-hmm. It's incredibly puzzling, right?
Yes.
So, and that, generally that's true for all sorts of things. You know, anytime you do a mitzvah le'ilui nishmat someone, or give tzedakah for a refuah shlema, like, how do I transfer my zechuyot to someone else? It's a huge question in Jewish philosophy. I think Rabbi Slifkin, Natan Slifkin, has some writing on this that I have not seen recently, so I can't summarize his approach. You could say one of two things. Either, yeah, really it doesn't work. Like really, improving my character doesn't help other people, and that might be more of like a mystical notion that we've adopted, even though it's not necessarily a rational kind of notion. Or we'll say that I become a good character, I deserve merit, and the thing that would make my life better is if my sibling wasn't sick. And so praying for you is a way of helping me. That could also work, and then it would really matter if you know the person, right? Like reciting a list in Amisha Beirach of names you don't know probably doesn't do as much as doing acts of kindness for close friends and relatives. Mm-hmm. But to discuss it more fully would probably take us a little too far afield. But yeah, if we're interested in doing like, you know, side conversation about like the utility of Tehillim, how Tehillim is used in the Jewish community, there's a lot to say about that as well. Okay, so we have two approaches right now. One is that Tehillim might be inspirational in the sense of, you know, divine inspiration. A second might focus on the philosophical inspiration we get from Tehillim. We learn and inculcate religious values. For me, I'll tip my hand. That's probably the most primary. In my study of Tehillim, I'm looking mostly for ways to improve my character and not only understand what the poem is saying, but also try to inculcate it into my religious life. That's the one that feels a little bit more practical than some of the other approaches we'll see. In source 10, this is just an arbitrary pasuk, but there are a lot of mizmorim that fit this bill. Mizmor Shir Chanukat Habayit LeDavid. So some mizmorim have liturgical functions. They were explicitly meant to be used in different ceremonies. So when inaugurating a Beit HaMikdash, David HaMelech writes a mizmor that is used in that context. We have the Shir Shal Yom, Mizmor Shir Liyom HaShabbat. So in the Beit HaMikdash, we recite this mizmor on Shabbos. So that's a musical purpose, right? We sing songs that maybe express certain ideas, and we do so as part of different ceremonies. So that's liturgy, and one thing that we'll definitely be doing is touching on mizmorim that have more liturgical focus, right? Ones that we say and recite more often for ourselves. I think that'll be most interesting and inspiring. Mizmor Shleom L'Chanukah D'Bayit also is incorporated into our Psukei D'Zemra. At least in Nuschot Ashkenaz. I don't know if other Nuschot do it, but yeah. Okay, great. So at least two of them, and then if any Yemenites are listening to this recording and can send me a message, let me know whether you do as well. I'd be happy to hear. Fine. And then the last point I think we already touched on from source 11, so we won't read it inside, just has to do with this the question I had raised before about whether we're studying Tehillim as the creation of a religious personality. We're trying to understand what a religious personality is like from a model of David or anyone else who wrote religious poetry, or whether we consider these to be more, you know, instructions or lessons that we're getting from the top down, from Hashem. And that has to do with what I saw from Sadia Gaon that I mentioned, which we won't recap now. But there could be an aspect of Tehillim that is actually teaching us, you know, information, right? So where Sefer Chinuch was describing sort of inculcating traits that we already understand. We already know we should trust in God, but let's inculcate that value deeply inside ourselves by studying Tehillim. We might also understand that Tehillim could just teach us important information, things that we don't know in our religious lives or in, you know, Jewish philosophy or in our relationships to Hashem, and that maybe we should try considering. So we'll try noticing those. So just to quickly summarize, and then we'll sort of point a path forward for ourselves. We discussed today the authorship of Tehillim, where it comes from, you know, the middle approach from the Gemara, that it's sort of David's compilation of earlier poems and editions of many of his own. The extreme view on the one hand that David wrote all of it, and the extreme view on the other that David, that even people after David were able to add to it, maybe like Shlomo, though Shlomo's not referenced in that list, interestingly, or Ezra or others. We discussed a little bit the modes of interpreting Tehillim, right? Interpreting it personally with a focus on David's life or the life of whoever the Mishorer, the author is, on the national life of the Jewish people, or universally, broad human problems. And we discussed some of the purposes we might aim to with our study of Tehillim, including, what for me are the most important, the ways that studying Tehillim can inform our religious lives more broadly, both by reminding us of religious ideas we already know and teaching us new ones that we might not have yet internalized. So where will we go from here? So I've already heard this as a group, but we've seen Tehillim before, relatively recently. But that said, that's not a reason necessarily not to see some Prakim again. My plan at the outset is to tackle some Mizmorim that we say frequently, and especially ones that might be a little bit more challenging to inculcate the religious lessons of, right? Like certain ideas are easier to absorb, certain ones are harder. We'll try selecting ones that are frequently recited and ones that whose understanding could really be enriching for us. Excuse me. And we'll try to, you know, go from there. After a couple of sessions, I think we'll sit down and see what approach we want to take, and which Mizmorim we would be most interested in studying. So for next week, as a spoiler, and also if anyone has time to prepare in advance and even do a little bit of, I'm not going to assign homework. I was a classroom teacher, and so recovering from that experience. So, but if anyone has a chance to read Mizmor Vav, which is what we say is Tachanun in davening, in advance, that would help us a little bit next time. I think we'll start with that, and I'll try and generally to give a little bit of advance notice what Prakim will take a look at if anyone wants to do extra preparation. And see those in advance, I think it'll help us get a little bit further in the time that we have together. I'm going to stop the recording now, but...